So, a little recap first on last week when Dana Samuja visited, and she talked about the inclusiveness of the Tri Ratna movement and order, that it's open to anyone who would like to join, be part of, come along to our activities. And she particularly talked about the equal ordination for men and women that we have in our order. So on an equal basis, men and women's ordination. She also talked a little bit about how a large amount of the order and movement are in India, and how moved she was when she spent time in India practicing with her Dharma brothers and sisters in India, quite a few of whom didn't speak English and actually were probably illiterate, some of them. So she had a sense of how different she is to them, how she couldn't actually communicate through speech, and yet there was such a sense of brotherhood, sisterhood, connection, how much she had in common with them, how moved she felt to be part of a Sangha with those very obvious kind of differences, those divides being not things that divide us, but that we come together across. So yeah, she talked a lot about transcending, didn't she, different kind of national barriers or social divides. So the various things that we might feel make us different to other people sometimes, whether it's nationality, class, caste, age, gender, disability, whatever it might be, none of those are differences that mean we can't share our lives together following the Buddha's teachings. So that was what she spoke about. I'm going to carry on somewhat with the theme, but in a slightly different way. So one of my titles was how to be inclusive when we're all so different. So kind of exploring, in a way, sometimes the kind of tension, hopefully creative tension, between diversity and coming together, being part of something, being unified, connected. For people who like clues, there's a little selection of objects on this corner of the shrine. For those who can't see, there's a mini deck chair, two cucumber seedlings called Tanya's, a little bundle of sticks with my name on it, and a wooden heart and a picture of Virochana. So you could solve the riddle. That is one of the answers to this question: how to be unified, connected, in harmony, inclusive, when we're all so different. So we talk a lot about the diversity in our Sangha, and this is a very positive thing to be celebrated. And that can also be quite challenging sometimes. So, you know, if we're a host of people with different temperaments, different preferences, different ways of working, ways of doing things, you might have sometimes had the experience when you've been doing things perhaps on a team or just helping out with other people on a Sangha night. Well, just in life generally, isn't it? Other people are different to us. And sometimes that's just mildly perplexing, that they would put the toothpaste there rather than there, or want to put away the charger for your phone rather than leave it out. Whatever it is, we're different to other people, and we can be mildly perplexed or highly irritated sometimes by their differences, or even sometimes experience it as slightly threatening, that difference can be worrying for us. So I think in that way as well, Sangha is a spiritual practice. So there's both the joy and the delight of it, and the companionship and the friendship and the encouragement, the love that we give each other. And then there's also the challenge and the grit in the oyster, which, if we are willing to embrace that as a practice, is a really, really growthful one. Seeing ourselves as other people see us. Having to enlarge our perspective to accommodate the radically different way that someone else might be seeing someone. So when there's a lot of difference, a lot of diversity, I think it means, it asks of us that we make more effort to stay in communication, stay in dialogue, to be in harmony. We kind of need to put a bit more effort into it, don't we? If we're with people who are just kind of quite easy and quite similar to us, we may not have to try so hard. So it just kind of asks a bit more of us, asks us to do a bit more listening, a bit more imagining what it's like to be on their mountain rather than our mountain. Probably more practice in the area of metta, whatever way we do that. And connecting with what we have in common, so perhaps with the values that we have in common, giving that attention and energy rather than focusing on what is different. So being in the order, which I have been for how many years? Maybe 7 or 8 years, is definitely a strong practice. Just being in the order is a practice, actually, and very much in that area of connecting with others, reaching across differences, connecting with people, going beyond yourself. So the order might look quite homogenous from the outside. I don't know whether it does, actually, but it's really not at all a homogenous thing. And I think when I first actually entered the order, and I remember reading the newsletter with reportings in by different order members, and I was kind of excited, stimulated, moved by the diversity. And there was a bit in me that also thought, how the heck does this thing stay together? Because the range of diverse views and experiences was just so vast. That I just thought, wow, that takes some doing, doesn't it, to kind of stay in dialogue, in connection with that amount of difference and diversity. So moving on a bit from diversity in our movement, in our Sangha, to look a little bit at the idea of the diversity within ourselves. So I was thinking, we don't always cope that well with the kind of different aspects of our own personalities, of our own selves, let alone coping with the difference of other people. I think most of us have an experience where it feels like there's quite a lot of different parts of ourselves. So there might be a bit of you that feels kind of quite hardworking and industrious, and then there's another bit which is a right layabout and just can't be bothered. And they're kind of both in there at different times. There might be a part of us that really cares about others, and then another bit which kind of judges them and others a bit, and actually can't be bothered to care that much just now. So we kind of have that mixture of experiences, of responses. We can be kind sometimes, and at other times we can just be a bit irritable and a bit grumpy. So, yeah, so we've got this kind of rich diversity in ourselves. There might be bits of ourselves that we find quite frustrating. They feel a bit intractable. They don't really seem to be pulling in the same direction. And we might get a bit fed up with them sometimes. We might even have the experience that sometimes some parts of us slightly bully other parts. Maybe there's some kind of stronger, more energetic, domineering parts of us that know where we want to go. And then there's other bits that are a bit more tender, a bit more hesitant, a bit less certain. And they can get a little bit bullied by the more kind of the bits that think they know what they want to happen and where they're going. So that was what I wanted to explore a little bit in the first half, really, was that experience of holding diversity within ourselves, and how we do that well. Because again, as in the Sangha, the diversity in ourselves can be quite stimulating, quite interesting, and also it can be quite challenging. So particularly if there's bits of ourselves that we think, oh, I don't know if I really like that bit very much. Maybe bits of us that aren't quite perfect, aren't quite what we'd like them to be. Sometimes we give those a label of the shadow, don't we? I think that's a kind of sort of psychological way of relating to those bits of ourselves that feel a bit darker or a bit less known to us, a bit murky, a bit less known to us because we'd rather not know them, we'd rather they weren't there. So kind of shadow material that is a bit harder for us to come into relationship with. And I think it's quite an important question to look at how we relate to the shadow in ourselves, how we respond to it in us, how we relate to it in our friends, or in people that we find difficult in the fourth stage of the metta bhavana, how we relate to it in our parents, our children, our teachers, how we relate to it in this sangha, in our founder, Sangharakshita. So how do we relate to shadow, to things that aren't perfect, are difficult, are not what we want in ourselves and in other people? And I've been pondering a bit that sense that how I relate to my own shadow will inform how I relate to shadow in other people. So in a way, the more I can kind of look at and find a way of meeting my own shadow with metta, then I think that has an effect on the way I'm able to meet the shadow in other people. So there's a very strong human tendency to turn away from things that we don't like. So we come across something that we don't like. One response is to avoid it, to push it away, to wish that it wasn't there, to kind of ignore it. So I kind of call that the turning away mode. It can either have a kind of ignoring quality or it can have a more active pushing quality. The Buddha talked about this quite a lot. The word he probably used most for it was aversion. We have aversion to things. So something that in our experience feels unpleasant, unwelcome. The general human reaction is to have aversion from it and not want to it and not want it. I think out on just on the lobby there, there's an image of the Wheel of Life, the Tibetan Wheel of Life image, and at the heart of it are three creatures chasing each other, and they symbolise the three root poisons that the Buddha talked about, of craving, aversion, and delusion. So we either want something or we don't want it. There's the pulling, the craving, or the pushing away, the aversion. And at its root are our delusion about ourselves and the world that leads us to have as much craving and aversion as we do. So we do it in so many ways, the turning away, whether it's our various favourite distractions, watching the telly or roaming the internet, prowling over to the fridge, opening the door, peering in, not quite sure what you're looking for, but there's got to be something in there that'll help. Toast, maybe. Quite often we're kind of distracting ourselves, aren't we? And sometimes it might be fine. We might actually be quite hungry and need something to eat. It might be that chatting with a friend, having a glass of wine, any number of these things could be quite unproblematic, might bring welcome ease and pleasure, relaxation into your day. And sometimes actually what's going on underneath them is that there's something else that's unpleasant that we're trying to get away from, turn away from. And so we've ended up looking for these nice experiences, because actually in some way we're slightly on the run from whatever it is that's a bit unpleasant. Yeah, so the Buddha talked about aversion a lot. In some of the secular mindfulness literature now, they talk about a particular mode of mind. We talked about it in our study group yesterday. And the label they give it is avoidance. Avoidance as a massive human strategy, a coping strategy, probably, and sometimes it may work quite well for us, and sometimes it might misfire. But avoidance is one of the big things that we do and that can make us very unhappy. In this article that I read, there were three things. It said there were three extremely unhelpful modes of mind that were likely to make us very unhappy. And one of them was avoidance. Two others, I don't know if anyone has any thoughts. What would you think were the three most unhelpful things that a human mind could do to itself? I was very shocked by one of them, because I see it in myself, and I hadn't thought it was quite that disastrous a thing. So there's avoidance. Then there is rumination, that kind of circling round and round unhelpfully. And then the last one is perfectionism. That's a bit of a blow, isn't it? So there you go. There's our three not very helpful things to do that the human mind tends to do. And taken to extremes particularly will make us unhappy. So I think one of the things that we're doing in meditation is working with that tendency in the human mind to avoid. So it's a bit of a gravitational pull to kind of zone out, seek distraction, to head off somewhere. And in a way, meditation, we're going against the grain of that. We're going against the gravitational pull, and we're turning towards our experience. So we're noticing things, we're being mindful of them, bringing things into awareness. There's lots of different ways of expressing that, isn't it? The turning towards, the being present with, aware of. And I think it's really important that we don't use meditation as a tool for repression. So I think fundamentally meditation is to help us move towards our experience, to allow in more and more. That is integrating, allowing in more and more of our experience. But because we have this strong tendency in us to avoid, to repress, to suppress things that we don't like, we can start to kind of use meditation as yet another way of doing that. So I think it's good to watch out if subtly your mind has recruited meditation as another way to avoid things. I had a nice conversation with Vajrapriya that delighted me, where we were talking about meditation. And what do you do when some kind of slightly troubling thought comes up that you might view as a negative thought? Maybe it's a bit of irritation or resentment, grumpiness, whatever it is. And it might be tempting to kind of, in a way, show it the door. Think, I know you, you're a negative thought, I'm not having you, off you go, I am coming back to the breath. And he said, oh, but there's something about, like, there's that negative thought, don't let it get away. Actually, we show it the door and it's gone. But it may have all sorts of gold in it. So that's a really different way of relating to distraction, isn't it? So I bet that quite a lot of us at some point have a habit of relating to our distractions in a way which is kind of, door, you, out. you know, we're kind of, we're showing at the door. We're not doing like, oh no, don't let it get away. Come back here, you little grumpy thought. Let me have a good look at you. What's going on with you? So I found that helpful. I sometimes drop that in if I catch myself ushering some part of my experience out of awareness. I think of Vajrapriya saying, oh, don't let it get away. Catch it by the tail. So there's a lot of emphasis in mindfulness, in the Buddhist teachings, on this acknowledging of what is actually going on, allowing experience. We can't integrate material unless we've actually clocked that it's there. So as part of integration, we need to be noticing, inquiring, being curious, acknowledging what's there. And also in the Buddhist tradition, there's a strong emphasis on discernment and seeing clearly what things are. So it's not just allowing everything, it's all fine, it's okay, I'll just take anything. There is also a wisdom perspective that can label a bit of grumpiness as a bit of grumpiness and might make some choices around what we do with it. But if we're too quick to put a judgmental label on something, it will close down on the process of discovery. So somehow we've got to balance these two qualities of allowing enough that we actually meet our experience and know it, and then bringing in wisdom. Not like a great whopping hammer that smacks things on the head, but that does see clearly and knows things for what they are. So, what we're going to do is a bit of an activity to explore the different parts of ourselves. So I'm going to give you a pen and paper in case you want to scribble it down. I think it's probably quite helpful too, actually. So I'm going to encourage you to list different aspects of yourself and give them little names. You might like just kind of fairly, just kind of quite straight labels, or you might quite enjoy giving things playful names. So some aspects of our psyches might be the hard worker, the joker, the grouch, the upright citizen, the critic, the lazy layabout, the rock and roll kid, the melancholy moon girl. So just there's a few examples to give you a flavour of having a sense of like what different parts of you are there in different situations, in different moods. Perhaps with different people, bring out different aspects of you. So the first invitation is to just kind of brainstorm a list of, well, at least 5, and you could really well get up to 20, I think, of these different kind of bits of yourself, with whatever kind of labels you might like to give them. So the next question is, what does each of those parts want? What do they want? So I have, one of my personas was a kind of overburdened world on my shoulder person, on my shoulders. And in a way, the way I perceive that bit of myself is a bit annoying, a bit serious. I wish it would go away. But when I ask, well, what does it want? Actually, I think what it wants is people to be happy. But how it manifests, you know, isn't always that enjoyable for me or others. So that's the question, to go through each of, well, you may have very long lists, but to go through a few and perhaps at least some that you have a positive response to and some that you have a less positive response to. And ask them, what do they want? So seeing the world from their perspective this time around. So just take a couple couple of minutes on your own just to do that. So I have to say that last question, how often does it get what it wants? When I first did this exercise, I found that a very sobering question. And it made me realise that there were kind of parts of myself, particular, needs, desires, wantings, yearnings in life, that were not really being given much of a chance to express themselves, to be there. That there were other parts of myself that were dominating and were not, perhaps not seeing them with much metta, not seeing what they were really trying to achieve. I think it led me to make some changes in my life. So I wanted to do this exercise because I think it has the potential to be a really good support for integration. So that's the first of the aspects of the Triratna system of practice, is integration. So actually that's represented here by this little bundle of sticks, which is tied together with a piece of string and has a label on it with my name on it. So it's Sangha actually uses an image for ourselves as being like, in a way, a loose bundle of habits tied together with string and labelled with a name and address. So in a way, that's one way of seeing ourselves, where this kind of bundle collection of different habits, some good habits, some not such good habits, with a label on it that says Saravantu or whoever it is. So exercises like this can help us kind of come into relationship with different parts of ourselves. The next stage in this activity is, if you want to do it on your own at some point, is to start trying to have dialogues between the different parts. You might think, oh, some of them actually got particular relationships. They might be on quite good terms or they might not be on very good terms. And actually letting them have a bit of a dialogue between them can be quite fruitful. So the mindfulness of breathing is classically one of the main initial practices that we teach to support integration. Other mindfulness-based activities like a body scan, more receptive, open practices like just sitting, can all be very helpful for that kind of movement of turning towards coming into relationship with meeting more and more aspects of ourselves.